It's not easy being a Democrat in the Missouri General Assembly, especially when Republicans outnumber you by a supermajority. But Representatives Lauren Arthur and John Carpenter are trying to make things better for their party and strategizing how to push their policy ideas forward. The two Kansas City area Democrats join us on another edition of Politically Speaking, so let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, a candid conversation with the Show Me State's biggest political newsmakers.
I'm Jason Mirzenbaum.
And I'm Joe Manis.
That's Eric Greitens, Navy SEALs running for governor, and I'm really, really glad to be on with you, Jason and Joe.
I'm going to push back on these regulators.
I'm doing this for the people.
I was encouraged along the way, not just by my family, but by a lot of teachers and professors, and knew when I was in college that I would run for office someday.
We're very excited about the prospect of having some more free market solutions.
Even though after the conversation, I still might not agree.
We want our listeners to get a real sense of what drives these people.
They're actually people with a story to tell.
And welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast, the only podcast about Missouri politics that will not be eclipsed by the eclipse next week. I guess that's possibly true, but that may not be. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio in St. Louis is
colleague Joe Manis.
And joining us from KCUR studio in beautiful Kansas City, Missouri, we have two special guests today. If you would, could you introduce yourself?
I'm Representative Lauren Arthur from Kansas City.
And Representative John Carpenter, also from KCMO.
Well, both Democrats, correct?
Correct.
Proud Democrats.
Proud Democrats. I'm really excited to have both of these lawmakers on for several reasons. Number one, I think it's a good thing for a St. Louis show like ourselves to make sure that we have people from the other side of the state. And the other is that I guess it's good to also have our competitors on because both of you have a podcast. And I guess sometimes it's better to crush your competition with flattery and respect rather than with snide remarks to
some extent. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Well, we're all about inclusion here.
we're all about inclusion. We'll get to that a little bit later. But as we do on all of our shows, we want to get to know our guests a little bit more. So I guess I'll start with Representative Arthur first. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into politics, what your district is, give us a sense of who you are and why you're even a legislator in the first place.
Well, I ask myself that question every day. I represent District 18, which is the greatest district in the world. And it's actually the district where I grew up, so I had a lot of fun knocking doors and running into people that I went to first grade with or played softball with. And I decided to run for myriad reasons, but primarily I taught at a school in the urban core in Kansas City, and I was shocked that my students were coming to school without their basic needs being met. They would come to school and show up. They were hungry. They hadn't had dinner the night before. They, you know, had a terrible night's sleep, and then they would come and we would expect them to achieve at high levels while also not having the funds to provide them with things like books. So that really resonated and stuck with me, and I thought that there needs to be a more comprehensive problem-solving approach to the fact that children in Missouri's basic needs aren't being met. And then on top of that, I looked at the makeup of the legislature and I saw that women were underrepresented. And at the time, young women were wholly unrepresented. So I was the only female elected official in her 20s when I got elected the first time. And I thought I could offer a unique perspective and a different voice on the issues.
Now, where exactly is your district so our listeners know?
For people familiar with Kansas City, it's in southwestern Clay County, so just across the river north of downtown. And this is not at all confusing, but I represent North Kansas City and then parts of Kansas City North.
Okay.
That is extremely confusing. But I also know that North Kansas City is a completely separate city from Kansas City proper, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yep, that's right. But so, both Kansas City and North Kansas City, everything's up to date there.
Oh, well, that's great. That's also the name Steve Kraske's radio show up there.
Well, that's a great song in Oklahoma.
So. Absolutely. So, Representative Carpenter, if you could give your bio and just tell people why you got involved in politics.
Yeah, you know, mine's very similar to Lauren's. From the area here in the Kansas City North area, and I represent the 15th District, which is actually the world's greatest district. Lauren was a little confused about that, but we'll forgive her. So that's got all of the city of Gladstone and then part of the Kansas City Northland. And, you know, I was mostly frustrated by what I was seeing. A lot of arguing and bickering in Jefferson City and not a lot getting done that actually benefits people. So I first got elected in 2012, decided to run, throw my hat in the ring. I've always been interested in public policy and public service, so was fortunate enough to get elected in 2012 and gotten reelected a couple of times since and really love the job.
So I want to talk a little bit about kind of the status that you're in right now. Both of you entered the legislature when the Democrats were pretty deep in the minority.
And they still are.
And they still are. And on the surface, that would not give either one of you much opportunity to affect public policy or the flow of legislation in the Missouri House. But one thing that I noticed this year is that the House Democrats seem to have more success at working behind the scenes and affecting major issues. It could be because the Speaker of the House, Todd Richardson, gives more autonomy and more ability for Democrats to influence the process. It could be just because you're better organized and more strategic and you've been able to be successful. That's my observation. I'd like to hear both of your thoughts of how both of you operate in this Missouri House the way the Democrats are right now.
You know, I think it takes you got to work on multiple levels, right? So on the one hand, you've got to be willing to fight the good fight and to actively defend your views and defend people in Missouri who need it. Because when you've got a supermajority in the legislature like we do in Missouri, and that kind of one-party rule, they have a tendency, I think, to play their, you know, a little overplay their hand. And so we've seen that on a lot of issues in the Missouri legislature. And I think it takes the minority party standing up for what they believe and being willing to speak out against it. So there's a lot of that that goes on. And I think that's a necessary part. But then obviously, you know, you've got to do both. So you've also got to be willing to make relationships with Republican legislators and work behind the scenes to get things done with them. So, you know, that's always been my view, is there's no reason you have to sort of choose a lane. I think sometimes people feel that way, that they either have to be the person who's throwing bombs or they have to be the person who's constantly working with Republicans. I think there, you can do a healthy balance of both, and I think that's what it takes.
Now,
I agree.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say I agree with that. And being in the super minority is as much fun as it sounds some days, but it's important that we're there and offering that different opinion. And I would say Republicans admit that they have too many Republicans at this point, and the balance has really gone out of whack. And so I think if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you should see that there's more need to move towards center, towards good public policy, as opposed to really partisan public policy. And then beyond that, we benefited this year because we had a lot of new and young talent come in that freshman class. And I'm really proud to work with our Democratic colleagues who just came in this past cycle. I think they add a lot. They've really energized the caucus. It's nice. It feels like a team and that we're all working towards the same goal. And they're just people that you like to work with. And so I think all of that and the ability to build relationships across the aisle and influence people, not in a devious way, but just influence them to move them towards what is more common sense.
Yeah, I covered, I was in Jeff City for the final week of the session, and I know it was particularly emotional in the House on various issues, such as the workplace anti-discrimination bill, which basically will make it harder for people to sue for discrimination, and some other major bills that came up during that final week. And because the Democrats are so outnumbered, you're kind of almost like peripheral players. It depends how much they want to allow you to speak just for the heck of it before the vote is taken. It's sort of like the outcome is already settled. Going forward towards the next session, which begins in January, do you see things, because the leadership's going to be the same, do you see things getting better, getting worse? Are there particular issues that already you're seeing where there might be some bipartisan movement? I'm just interested in your thoughts.
The thing that concerns me is that it's an election year. And during election years, it seems like politics comes more into play than actually solving the problems in the state. So you get a ton of abortion laws, you get a ton of gun laws, you get those divisive issues that really rally a base. So I worry, just because of the nature of election years, that it might get worse. But in terms of, you know, what Republicans have been pushing, it's not great right now. So,
yeah, it's hard for me to imagine it getting a lot worse, to be honest. You know, I try to have eternal optimism in the job, because that's what it takes to hope that next year will be better than the year before. So I always think it's possible. But yeah, for it to get worse, if you look back at what happened legislatively this year, between that discrimination bill, which makes it substantially easier for employers to get away with the kind of discrimination that was outlawed in this country decades ago. So I think it really takes us decades in the wrong direction. Between that and all the cuts to services like at-home services for the disabled and elderly, you know, it's a long list. You got right to work, which I think is going to further tilt the balance of power to the corporate world and away from working people. You've got the abortion laws. It's a long list of things that we did this year. So it's hard for me to imagine the 2018 legislative session being a lot worse. So I am hopeful that my Republican colleagues can sort of move past the hot button red meat controversial issues and actually work on issues like improving education and roads and bridges and things that hopefully we could find bipartisan agreement on.
I mean, it looks like the right to work bill that the General Assembly passed and the governor signed last session is going to be put in limbo, so to speak, because labor appears to have more than enough signatures to force a referendum next November. My question is, the fact that, let's say, by the time you get there in January, it's going to be clear if it's made the ballot. So in other words, do you think that there may be tensions because of that? Other labor-related stuff brought up because of that?
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't surprise me. Although, to be honest, if anything, I think a lot of the tension will be within the Republican caucus. You know, from what I understand, there's a lot of them who are upset that they passed the bill so early in session, which has helped to allow for this moment to, gave organized labor more time to do the gathering of signatures. And plus, you know, labor is an issue that somewhat divides Republicans. There are a handful of them who oppose these anti-worker laws. So will they come after labor again? Probably. I mean, they've been doing it for years. Now they've got the biggest supermajorities they've ever had, plus the governor's mansion. So on issues like prevailing wage and others, I imagine they will come back and try again. You know, one of the issues that concerns me is on unemployment benefits. They are constantly trying to undermine unemployment insurance for workers, which, of course, is for working people. It's for people who get laid off, you know, fired not for cause. It's a really important part of the social fabric in this country, I think. And, I think there are a lot of issues like that that I'm watching out for.
Now, how do you think you there's been talk that there might be another special session because of the in-home care cuts. excuse me. But some others say, no, that's not going to happen. They may try to work out something next session. I'm just interested in what you're hearing from your constituents about the cuts, or what you think may happen in the next few weeks or months.
Yeah, I've heard from a lot of constituents on this issue, and people who are really burdened by the decision made in Jefferson City. I think it was both bad public policy and morally indefensible to veto what was a rare bipartisan solution to the problem. It means that the cuts mean that more people are going to end up in the emergency room or in institutions, and ultimately Missourians are going to be the people footing that bill. And I've talked to those constituents who they're going to lose their in-home services, or they're people who, because of other legislation, have lost their subsidy for prescription drugs. And the burden on them and their families is really unimaginable and heartbreaking. And, you know, these are people who've paid their taxes throughout their lives. In many cases, they served their country in various ways. And they want to live with a little dignity. But it's shameful that those are the people who were targeted before corporations or other interest groups. And so in terms of moving forward, I have recently started hearing the rumor of a special session to address it, or something during the veto session time to come together and work on the issue. But I feel like that solution has already been delivered, in the fact that it has no support among the Republican leadership of the party, including the governor. It makes me nervous and feel like maybe that it's not going to be addressed.
Well, that's actually a good segue to our first clip, which is from Representative Justin Offerman, who's not the governor, but he is the vice chairman of the House Budget Committee. I know that several of your Democratic colleagues have talked about overriding what is known as HCB3, which I'm summarizing it here, would basically take a whole bunch of unused money from a bunch of boards and commissions in state government and use it to restore about 8,000 people to in-home and nursing home care. I just want to make sure I'm describing that accurately to either a guest or Joe, first of all.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
As far as I understand.
So this is what Representative Offerman brought up about the prospects of overriding that bill when legislators come back for veto session.
That is, in my opinion, as part of this discussion, ludicrous. And here's why. The governor has already said and stated that he hates this bill. He believes it's unconstitutional. And the bill itself, even if we did override it, it gives the governor the authority to make the transfer. The governor has already said he doesn't like the proposal and thinks it's unconstitutional. So in what universe would overriding the governor or doing another bill that was a fund sweep make sense? Because the governor simply won't make the transfer. So, in essence, the Senate version of House Committee Bill 3 is a farce. It's never going to happen, because Governor Greitens has indicated that the transfer will not go through. So any solution that includes a fund sweep, how the Senate did it, is not going to work. And I don't believe, even if we did get it passed, it's not going to do anything, because the governor simply won't make the transfers.
I know that that was strong words by your colleagues, but it does seem like he has a point that simply overriding HCB3 does not really seem to be a practical solution to this problem. What's kind of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I don't know. So let me stipulate that as to our earlier conversation of working with Republican members, Representative Offerman is one of my very favorites. He's a great person and I think does good work down in Jefferson City. But I think the reasoning of this plan can't work because the governor won't let it work isn't much reasoning, right? I mean, he's saying that we can't solve this issue, the issue being that 8,000 of our fellow Missourians are going to lose their in-home care, many of whom will be forced out of their homes as a result, that we can't solve the issue because the governor refuses to play ball, that even if we were to override it, the governor would refuse to do it. Well, that's a choice. So, you know, political actors in Missouri are making a choice not to solve this issue. It's not that it can't be solved. We're talking about $13 million. There's about $13 million in cuts here. The idea that we can't solve it is to me, false. I think we clearly can, and I think Republicans, whether they're in the General Assembly or whether we're talking about the governor, who is an elected politician, even if he doesn't want to admit it, is making a choice not to solve the issue.
And I'm going to play a second clip from Representative Offerman, because this was talking about the possibility of a special session. I think one thing that we need to make sure our listeners know is that for the legislators themselves to call themselves back into special session, you need around 149 or 150 senators and representatives. And he mentioned that that's not a likely scenario. But even if you did get legislators to take this issue up and come up with a new plan, this is one of the difficulties that Representative Offerman foresees.
So in order for this bill to even have the effect that we want, we have to come up with a funding mechanism of how to get tens of millions of dollars to home and community-based services. So therein lies another problem of, okay, if we do call ourselves back in, where are we going to find the revenue to restore these services with the current budget that we have? That's another huge problem that I don't think anyone's talking about.
In addition to kind of responding to that, I'd like both of your opinions about whether the legislature should come back into session to deal with this. Because as you mentioned, this is affecting thousands of people. It is going to result in losing critical health care for people. What do you make of the representative's comments, and do you think that this issue is worthy enough for legislators to come back into special session for?
Yeah, we should do whatever it takes to ensure that, you know, these 8,000 people or more won't suffer as a result of that inaction. So I'm all for a special session if that's what it takes to fix and solve the problem. It is worth mentioning why we're facing a several hundred million dollar budget deficit in the first place. And that, in my opinion, has a lot to do with the fact that Republicans have been in power for the past decade, and a lot of their decision-making involves tax cuts and special interest tax credits to different groups. And that starts to add up. So, you know, it's $10 million in tax cuts here. It's $10 million in tax cuts here. And, of course, I think it was Senate Bill 19 that was passed a few years ago.
I believe you're right, yeah.
That it was expected to cost the state somewhere around $20 million, and it ended up costing somewhere closer to $200 million.
Yes.
So they, you know, everyone acts like this budget crisis just fell from the sky, and there's no sort of ownership of the problem in the first place, and certainly no sort of, you know, our neighbors to the west in Kansas have accepted the fact that it was their decision-making that ultimately led to some of the problems that they saw in their state. Missouri hasn't gotten to that place where they acknowledge that, you know, tax cuts ultimately end up cutting services for senior citizens and people with disabilities. So I'd like to see just an acknowledgement of that in the first place and not a continuation of the same failed policies.
Yeah, well, and that's the only way we're going to fix the issue, right? The only way you're going to stem the tide is by acknowledging that when you pass these special interest tax giveaways, that they have an effect on, for example, in-home care programs. And that doesn't seem to be in the discussion. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions, north of $1 billion every year in tax cuts that have passed this legislature over the past decade. It adds up. So when we're talking about a $20 million shortfall here or $30 million here, you know, we cut higher ed this year by $70 million. And basically the reasoning was, well, we have a $500 million budget shortfall and we've got to cut some fat. And, you know, gee, we sure wish we didn't have to cut $70 million from higher education, from our four-year public universities and our community colleges. We agree that those are important, but we just have to do it. Well, we have to do it because of decisions that have been made and are continuing to be made. And, you know, I just wish that our elected leaders cared as much about keeping disabled Missourians in their homes as much as they do about handing out tax giveaways to the wealthy and to corporations. And if they did, then we wouldn't be facing this kind of issue.
And I'll say, I know some of our Democratic colleagues are looking into a review of tax credits and tax cuts. And obviously it's easy when you're in the opposition to point the finger and say, fix it. But we're actually trying to be proactive and looking at areas where we can restore some of the revenue funding for the sake of the state.
We're going to take a short break where I'm going to tell our listeners about the stories Joe and I are working on. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Be sure to read my story at stlpublicradio.org about how the majority of homicide victims in St. Louis are aged 29 years old or younger, and what city leaders are planning to do to reduce those grim statistics. Also, be sure to check out Joe Manis's story about how labor unions in Missouri are trying to reverse right to work at the ballot. You can also subscribe to Politically Speaking by typing in Politically Speaking in the iTunes podcast search. Now back to the show. And we're back on Politically Speaking. It's a bi-state Politically Speaking here with Jason Rosenbaum, Joe Manis, and Representatives Lauren Arthur and John Carpenter, who are in Kansas City right now. And I wanted to talk about the relationship between legislators from St. Louis and Kansas City. What is the relationship like between the two, and what struggles and successes have you had recently?
I mean, I've always found it to be fairly positive. I think the interests are often in common between the two biggest cities in the state, and I think often you'll find members from St. Louis and Kansas City needing to sort of unite together to defend our position against what is often a more rural-dominated General Assembly. I've always found it to be a healthy working relationship.
Right, and sometimes we are united in our opposition to what the rural lawmakers are doing. So a lot of times Kansas City and St. Louis locally pass their own laws, and then those laws eventually end up preempted by lawmakers in Jefferson City. And so I think there is sort of that recognition of things. I know in Kansas City, things are going really well, and it feels like the city is growing and thriving and doing a good job. But often lawmakers in Jefferson City feel like they disagree with some of the more progressive policies in place in Kansas City. And we see that in St. Louis, too. There's a movement in Jefferson City to preempt. And, I think there is a common interest in preserving the good things that are going well in Kansas City and St. Louis. And sometimes we're successful in defeating it, and sometimes we're not. In terms of Kansas City, you're right that it is a very bipartisan delegation, and where the interests of Kansas City lie, we try to work together. And one of the things that succeeded in this past year was bonding for UMKC Conservatory. Now, it was vetoed by Governor Greitens, but that was really led by Republicans, though it was supported overwhelmingly by Democrats. And I think we got a lot of support from the St. Louis side as well.
Now, that's true. Yeah, they did.
Now, one of the big issues right now that unite the two cities' delegations is the fight over the local minimum wage hikes. The General Assembly and the governor signed a bill that basically does away with the City of St. Louis's wage hike to $10 an hour. That'll happen in just a few days. I know that Kansas City has something similar coming up. So what's your sense of what the two urban areas might do to try to fight that, or can they? Just kind of your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, one thing I would add to that, Joe, is, I wish it was the entire delegation from Kansas City and from St. Louis defending, our local autonomy in that regard. It's really not. Every Republican from the Kansas City area and the St. Louis area voted with the majority in Jefferson City to take away the right of Kansas City and St. Louis to set their own local minimum wage. So it's really been a Democratic versus Republican issue, which is unfortunate. I don't think it has to be. I think minimum wage, you do a poll anywhere in the greater KC or greater St. Louis area, and you're going to find overwhelming support from Democrats, independents, and a lot of Republicans. So I've been a little disappointed to see what's happened, which is, a pretty massive overreach by politicians in Jefferson City who are constantly complaining that the federal government is trying to take away the state's rights, and, you know, it's a big, bad federal government stepping in where they shouldn't, and then they turn around at the state level and do the exact same thing to cities within Missouri, taking away the right of the cities to set a higher minimum wage. And in St. Louis, I just think it's the most egregious example of it that I've ever seen, and probably that the country's ever seen, where we're actually literally lowering the minimum wage for more than 30,000 workers in St. Louis. People who are currently, today, as we record, making $10 an hour, who yesterday woke up, went to work, and made $10 an hour, and the day before, and for weeks, made $10 an hour, and come August 28th, because of decisions that Republican politicians in Jefferson City made, a lot of them are going to see their paycheck go from $10 an hour to $7.70 an hour, or to $7.80 an hour, or $7.90 an hour, which is, you know, a more than 20% decrease in salary for people who are already struggling to get by. It's been really sad to watch.
And I'd say it's totally counter to Missourians' values. There should be consensus agreement that if you're working full-time, if you're hardworking, then you should be able to meet your basic necessities like shelter, food, lights, those kinds of things. And we heard from many minimum wage workers who weren't able to put food on the table because they weren't making enough money, or who had to make difficult decisions between healthcare or, making a car payment. And I just think that that doesn't really jibe with what we as Missourians believe. In terms of legislative action, we heard time and time again during the course of the debate that they would love to see a higher minimum wage, but it has to be a statewide minimum wage. And then we'd respond, okay, great. Are you going to sponsor that legislation next year? And can you commit that it will make it to the finish line? And then people started backing off of that comment. Ultimately, I think it's going to take a vote of Missourians, and I anticipate that would succeed overwhelmingly, but I know there are a number of initiative petitions underway trying to get enough signatures so that will go on the ballot and that we'd raise our statewide minimum wage.
So yeah. Do you think that getting it on the ballot's the only option at this point looking forward? I mean, philosophical differences aside, it's a fact that the Republicans have such a majority they can block any legislative effort to try to restore the higher wage.
And just to add a little bit of detail to that question, if a lot of money from labor unions are going to defeat right to work, and labor unions were the main source of money to raise the minimum wage in 2006, is there going to be enough resources to get both on the ballot?
That's a good question, and a fair one. I do think that the ballot initiative is probably the most likely avenue for success. I know there's one out there right now that would increase the state minimum wage to $12 an hour by 2023, a 75-cent increase over the next 6 or 7 years to get us there. And I fully support that. I wish there was a solution within the state legislature. I will continue to work for one. I will continue to, you know, encourage my Republican colleagues to support a statewide increase in the minimum wage. And in fact, we offered during the debate on the preemption bill earlier this year, we offered a bunch of amendments, offering them any number they wanted in terms of increasing the minimum wage, and they voted them all down. So we'll continue to try the legislative route, but I do think it seems to make sense that the most likely route at this point is a ballot initiative. And I think it would pass overwhelmingly. You know, Kansas City just by a huge margin passed a minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. Now, it won't go into effect, most likely, because of the state law. But, you know, if we got that kind of a margin on a $15 an hour minimum wage, which is a pretty big increase, I think we can all agree, I think a more scaled down $12 an hour statewide initiative would see similar results. I think it would pass pretty overwhelmingly. When it was last on the ballot in 2006, it was well over 70%. I'd have to go back and look exactly what, or maybe it was around 70. I don't know. Who knows? But it was huge, the margin. And so even if it wasn't as well financed in 2018, I think that the issue itself is politically popular enough. And I think you get it on the ballot, and I think it passes. That's what I think.
I do have to ask this question, and people who listen to this show often know I bring this up a lot. In 2013, there was a bill that basically preempted St. Louis and St. Louis County's foreclosure mediation ordinances. I noticed that most Democrats in the House and the Senate voted for that, including a lot of people from the Kansas City area. Representative Carpenter, I believe you were one of the people in the House to do that. I'm just curious why there's an emphasis on fighting to keep ordinances for minimum wage alive, but there wasn't much of an effort to keep those foreclosure mediation ordinances in St. Louis County alive.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fair point. It was an issue that wasn't debated as thoroughly as the issue we're talking about right now. So in terms of could the state legislature have gone a different direction on that issue, you make a fair point that that might be true. My recollection of that at the time was that folks were saying that you had to have consistency on the mortgage process and the foreclosure process. Obviously banks are operating in more than one venue. That being said, yeah, I would be happy to revisit that issue if folks feel like it should be.
And it was kind of a moot point anyways. The ordinances were found unconstitutional, but I have brought it up many times because I followed that issue closely, and sure. You know, it's almost an obsession of mine, I'll admit it.
In general, I would agree with you. I don't think the state needs to be injecting itself into city ordinances. I think there are times when it's necessary, but Jefferson City has overplayed its hand significantly over the past decade plus in terms of getting involved in city issues.
So I just can't believe that politicians would be ideologically inconsistent sometimes. That's unimaginable, hard to believe.
It is impossible to believe. I mean, every politician is consistent 100% of the time. That's what we found out. I do want to kind of shift a little bit into politics in the last few minutes that we have. I know that Representative Arthur is the treasurer of the Missouri Democratic Party. And while Representative Carpenter doesn't have an official role on the political side, I know that you follow the ebb and flow of politics carefully. I think there's been a lot of discussion about where the Missouri Democratic Party goes from here after the last election cycle.
Where you got shellacked.
And I'm interested to hear both of your views on this, because I do sense that there is a younger generation that is taking over the party. You have one of your former colleagues, Representative Stephen Weber, who's now the chairman. He's 11, 12, 13 months older than I am. I'm 33, by the way. And it does seem like there is kind of a new approach and a new focus, but the question is that actually going to be beneficial for the party? So I'm interested to hear both of your perspectives on that.
Yeah, well, I have complete confidence in our new leader, Stephen Weber. I think he's doing a great job in showing up to areas, showing up everywhere, which hasn't been done for a long time and is really the first important step. I think we have reason to feel encouraged, especially in light of the recent special election. I know we lost. I know people will say, it doesn't, none of it matters because ultimately that candidate is not going to have the opportunity to influence legislation in Jefferson City. But it is a really encouraging victory and sense of momentum and energy going forward. And that candidate, Michaela Skelton, outperformed the top of the ticket by about 10 points. So I think you can look at that and say momentum is in our favor and heading our direction, and that our job is to make sure that when that tide comes, that we're taking full advantage of it and having everything in place to make sure that we're picking up as many seats as possible.
So are you assuming that there's going to be this Democratic tide in 2018 because of what's happening in Washington, or do you think some of the stuff that's happening in Jeff City is going to do that? And is that kind of dangerous to assume that when we've got 15 months yet to go?
You're right. It's a long ways off, and who knows what can happen in those 15 months. Hopefully not nuclear holocaust with North yeah. Korea. I think it's hard to predict, but from my experience the past few years in the legislature, Republicans always had someone to point to and say, it's this person's fault. So at the state level, it was always Governor Nixon's fault, who's a Democrat. It's always the Democrats' fault. At the national level, they always had Obama to point to and say, it's this person's fault. Republicans own everything that's happening in the state and everything that's happening nationally. And I think, you know, I think a lot of Missourians, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, are really disappointed in the direction and just dysfunction that we've seen at both the state and national level. So there's no one to point to anymore. And it's our responsibility to make them own it, but then also show what Democrats can offer and the fact that we're standing up for the people in the state who often don't have that voice.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important that we, at the state level and the national level, that the Democratic Party do everything it can to make itself a competitive, viable party that appeals to a broad swath of voters. And I think that's happening in the state of Missouri right now under some efforts that are underway. And I look forward to 2018, seeing how that plays out. That being said, I do think it's important. The national storyline is important. I think that what you see out of Washington, D.C. is going to affect local races in every state in the nation because, in my view, it's a disaster. They're getting nothing done. They have no major legislative accomplishments. And we have a president in the United States who, on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, demonstrates his deep, deep unfitness for the office. And I do think that by the time 2018 rolls around and people got to head out to the polls, that's going to have a major effect.
I did want to touch on that because we're taping this a day after President Trump I don't want to editorialize here, Joe, but it seems like it's almost an infamous press conference at this point regarding the skirmishes in Charlottesville.
Yeah, although I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I mean, often things like that, everyone's like, oh my gosh. And then, especially in the case of Trump, a week later, we're on to something else. I mean, I'm not trivializing it. I'm just making an observation because there's been a number of significant things that either Trump has said or done over the last 2 years that really haven't, at the bottom line, within a week, they haven't affected really his standing that much.
And that's what I was trying to get at with my question. Obviously, the president has said or done almost an endless amount of controversial things that in any other state that would probably hurt Republicans there. We live in a state where the president won by almost 20 percentage points. And the question I've been asking is this backlash going to be enough to propel Democrats if there's such a large base of support around the state for him? So I'd be interested in both of your takes on that.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure the extent to which this really will change anything. I can't imagine that the majority of Missourians think what happened over the weekend was okay and agree with any of the comments that Donald Trump made in response to it. I don't think people believe that Donald Trump represents their morals or their beliefs. But I think it's interesting the Missouri GOP in a tweet, they felt comfortable and compelled to basically applaud the president during his press conference, which puts them on the same side as David Duke.
Totally correct. Right around the same time you had it's amazing. And by the way, a decent number of serious elected Republicans throughout the country condemned his remarks yesterday, and they should have. I mean, what its ultimate effect will be in November of 2018 at the polls is, as we're all agreeing here today, I think, is impossible to say. But what he did yesterday, regardless of that, was wrong. It was wrong. I mean, we had the president of the United States go out and say that people who protest neo-Nazi rallies are just as bad as neo-Nazis and the KKK. I mean, it was appalling. And regardless of where it takes us politically, it deserves condemnation, and we deserve a new president.
I just want to make this up. First of all, I want to actually read the actual tweet you were referring to. It says, America also has a president that isn't afraid to take on the hypocrisy and intimidation tactics of #fake news. Way to go, real Donald Trump. And then there was an emoji with the two hands going up in the shape of, I guess, a half rectangle. And that was retweeting a tweet that Fox News said, the country is booming. The stock market is setting records. We have the highest levels of enthusiasm. This Fox News tweet doesn't mention the other things he said at the press conference. I'm not making an editorial judgment on that tweet. I'm just letting our listeners know what it is. And I will just make this final observation that maybe I could bounce off of both of you. I was actually in Columbia, Missouri 10 years ago when Nazis marched there. And I was part of a very large crowd. And it was a crowd that where a element of it did try to get hostile and violent with the Nazis. There were 7 or 8 people arrested there. And I did not hear a single person in Missouri politics on either side condemn the counter-protesters there. I heard actually no reaction from Missouri's political community. So it is kind of striking to compare that situation, which is obviously not the same situation. There are more neo-Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville than there were in Columbia 10 years ago. But it's a very similar idea where this group of essentially Nazis come to try to provoke a crowd, which has happened before in many instances. I didn't really hear a lot of outcry about the counter-protesters then, and I'm sure you didn't either.
Yeah, although 10 years, a lot of things have happened, and one could say that the climate has become more racially charged nationally. Without getting into the weeds, but the point is it seems like tensions are higher on all sides right now. For various reasons.
And the president bears a lot of responsibility for that. So he ran an entire campaign on fanning those flames. And, you know, the people who went out to the rally yesterday they were saying, look, we're here. We've got our president now. You know, we're ascendant. We're finally our cause is where it should be. So, I mean, these things are deeply connected. And the president has a lot of responsibility, and you know, I think he chose sides. I think he chose sides.
Yeah, and I think it's coherent to say we should condemn violence where it takes place, but it's important to remember that the event was organized by white nationalists, and then on Friday we saw masses carrying Nazi flags and torches, you know, chanting things that venerate a really evil leader and regime. They were supporting it, basically the elimination of entire groups of Americans based on race or religion or creed. And then on Saturday, we saw someone use ISIS tactics and drive a car into a crowd, killing a young woman. So what the reaction to is obviously those events, but also Donald Trump's response to those events, which is basically to welcome white supremacists and Nazis into the commons while also telling, you know, the groups targeted by hate groups that their place in society is not what they thought it was.
Before we, like, do the whole where you are on Twitter thing, I do want you both to give as big of a plug as you can to your own show, because I have listened to it before. I think that it is I'm trying to think of a funny way to describe it to our show without sounding like a jerk. But but just tell us a little bit about your show, because I think it is interesting that there are legislators now who are using the podcast format to get their message out. Give the listeners a sense of what you guys do.
Well, first of all, it's the best show. Maybe that's what you're looking for. Tremendous. Huge.
It's splendiferous.
There you go.
It's called Podgressive. You see what we did there? It started basically as a way to allow folks back home an inside peek at what's happening down in Jefferson City. I think we had the intention of letting most of our constituents receive updates via podcast. And it's been interesting to see it grow. There are a lot of people in rural parts of the state who listen and feel more connected because maybe they don't have a Democrat representative, and so they're not hearing another side of the story. And it's a way to keep people informed and updated. We cover a local issue in Kansas City. We cover a few state issues. And then we also talk national politics because we can't help ourselves. So it's a way to stay informed and
yeah, it's a lot of fun. We enjoy doing it, and we've had folks who have let us know they're listening from cities all across the state, including some that I've never heard of. So it's been really cool, and we've got a cool mashup pod coming up here in just a couple of weeks with a national pod, and we'll put that out and hope everybody will tune in.
Hopefully, one of the cities is Knob Noster.
I'm sure we've got some Knob Noster.
I love just saying Knob Noster as much as I can. Well, I just want to thank both of you for being on the show. I want to thank KCUR for hosting you and for setting this all up. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's JManNies.
You can follow Representative Arthur on Twitter at
Rep. Lauren Arthur.
And I do not believe Representative Carpenter is on Twitter. It's been kind of a running gag in Missouri politics that you've decided not to enter that cesspool of
alternate
social
universe.
Media. Is that true?
It is true. You know, your words, cesspool and alternative universe, reflect my views as of 2017. I could always change, but
don't indulge
as
him.
Of now.
He just likes people begging him to get on Twitter.
I am on Facebook, though.
Yes. Search his name on Facebook. I think I liked you a long time ago.
Well, so. Thank you. I like you too.
You're very welcome. We'll be back next time. Until then, so long.